So welcome everyone, welcome tonight. I'd like to start off, as I do, with an overlay of Buddhism and where it goes, and then bringing this specific of the state of mind that we're looking at into that context. And the quote I'd like to offer tonight is a Buddha quote by the Buddha, where he says, "There is an unborn, uncreated, unconditioned, unformed. Were it not for the unborn, uncreated, unconditioned, unformed, there would be no escape from the world of the born, the created, the conditioned, and the formed." So it's because of the unconditioning, of the unconditioned, that there is an alternative to the life that we live with such tension, with such stress, with such dissatisfaction, and also with such esteemed pleasure and sort of self-promoting circumstances. And what we're trying to see is that when we live in accordance with the conditioned, the formed, then there's a certain tension to life, a certain way that we are not seeing the complete picture, for one, but more specifically, we are contained within that so that we really don't have any alternatives because we are so habituated in our response to certain states of mind that we live in accordance with what that state of mind might be saying at any particular time. And the Buddha is not suggesting here that we create an alternative to that, but cause to create an alternative to the conditioned is just to reify or deify the unconditioned into an objective thing that we are moving towards. And because the unconditioned is manifested everywhere at all times, it's not to try to make it into an object to obtain, but rather to see the limitation of the condition, the conditioning that we're under, to see the limitation of how it is that we compel ourselves moment after moment through our habit, through our normal and usual responses that keep us from partaking in the unconditioned, in the completeness of life as it is offered. Now, it's that evolution from the conditioned to the unconditioned which is the journey of the spiritual. And it's really the evolution towards a new consciousness, towards a new paradigm. And what we're doing here, or offering here, is for us to look at certain states of mind, and we've gone through a number of them, to see if those states of mind, in their normal way that we are habituated to them, are offering us the prize of the goal that they seem to, or are there lots of pitfalls along the way that make it less than what it seems to be? And for instance, we've talked about anger, we've talked about shame, we've talked about fear, we've talked about a whole number of different states of mind, and always the point is that they seem to say something that's very important and very dramatic at the time they're occurring. But if we just hold our place with those states of mind and not give over to the belief system that's contained within them, nor the emotional response that seems to arise as they arise, we find a very different way to be able to navigate through those states of mind than if we just react and follow suit. And tonight we're going to be looking at another, a new state of mind. Now, I'm not going to, I mean, there are endless numbers of states of mind, and we could just spend years and years looking at each one. But what we're trying to do is give a methodology to this. So how is it that we can look at a state of mind and see how it divides us out, to see how it separates us, to see how there's a contention that's formed within that separation, how we make the world problematic by looking through that state of mind and objectifying the world from it, which is all the conditioned reality does to us. And is that the truth? Is there another way to hold the truth, to ask questions about that state of mind so that we aren't so governed by those conditioned patterns? Now, it's interesting, I'm just getting back a little bit jet-lagged. I'm just getting back from 12 days away, in which part of that time was at a all-Buddhist conference at Garrison in New York. There are some 200 Buddhists, sort of the archdiocese. And there are the big names and the smaller names. And but what I got a feeling for, which is very, really very uplifting, was that there was less judgment between the traditions. There's less tension, less objectification of one tradition compared to another. And much more of a sense that this movement of into the new consciousness, each of us had a role to play within that. And that there was no one that was special within that, that we were all moving it forward, very gently, nudging it forward. There was Jonny Kabat-Zinn on the one side, who has no particular home in a Buddhist tradition, but talks about really secular mindfulness. And all of that, everybody together, was the whole range of what we were doing was nudging life into a new and renewed consciousness. And it was quite inspiring. I thought also one of the reasons for the conference was that there was a kind of a handover, a torch that was being offered to the younger Buddhists teachers. Younger, 45 and under, is now the younger Buddhist teacher, by the older ones. And in the beauty of that passage, it's the first time in the West that we've had a generational shift like this. And the young ones, they wanted us to acknowledge and to save, in effect, you know, it's going to change. Dharma as we know it is going to change under our guidance, and wanted our blessing. And to a person, I think the older generation said, what can we do to help you? You know, how can we help you through this? We want you to succeed. There was no sense of tension whatsoever between those two generations. And it was a beautiful representation of how we move seamlessly through the evolution of time. But this evolution of consciousness from being unconscious to this shift of paradigm where consciousness itself, being aware itself, is at the heart of everyone's life is really what Buddhism has always been about, although not often expressed in those ways. It certainly is in its central issue, in its core teaching, a teaching in which consciousness is, we are moving from the unconscious to the conscious. And so what we have to do is we have to look at the old ways that we have been set in unconscious tendencies to ourselves. We aren't going to move this thing into a new conscious orientation if we aren't willing to look at where we have been unconscious. When we look at where we've been unconscious, that actual looking makes the unconscious conscious. That's what the definition is. An unseen habit is an unconscious tendency. A seen habit no longer is a habit. It's flushed out. It's becomes the very conscious expression of that evolution itself. So when we're looking at these different states of mind, which we're looking at set ways that we have reacted to them unconsciously. We have believed in them. We have invested in them. We have taken the world from its emotional response, internal emotional response. And we have missed something very vital and important because we have done just that. And it takes an enormous amount of courage for us to shift out of that pattern, because we know ourselves through that pattern. We know ourselves through our conditioning. But to be willing to shift out of that pattern, because there's no guarantees that life will be better just because we've been conscious, made ourselves conscious of these old tendencies. And the fear is that it won't be better, it'll be worse. I won't even, may not even know myself. What will I be like if I don't follow the same cause and effect that I've always known? But so this sense of the resolution of heart that says, I'm not going to let the mind dictate its perceptions of reality to me any longer. It's not going to do that. And then I have to find out where I'm just one domino falling after another. I'm going to take out that next domino, and I'm going to look and see so that I no longer just follow reactive pattern after reactive pattern after reactive pattern. This is what we're about. This is why we're together. And it requires much more than listening passively to a lecture once a week. It requires your intention to express your life through this new evolutionary spirit. That's why homework is offered. That's why we do all the things we do on the off weeks. Because I think the off weeks are actually more important than the on weeks, if the talk night is called an on week. Because the off weeks, we start digging in. We start putting our fingernails into the grind and grit of the soil of life. It's not just a passive church-going activity of listening to a discourse. So we're going to look tonight at the state of boredom. So let's see what boredom is. And we're going to bring forth some of the earlier teachings within this Satipatthana Sutta, because we did go through what we called the second foundation, which was Vedana, or feelings, the neutral, the pleasant and unpleasant feelings that the mind conditions itself to with experience, through experience. And so when we look at boredom, we're looking at centrally a neutral experience that's gone amok, that's turned sour on us, right? But it was a boredom before it became bored, before we became bored within it, was, if you look, there's nothing going on. There's nothing exciting to entice us. There's nothing very aversive to draw us away. It simply is a kind of normal or ordinary experience at hand. But that is not good enough for the sense of self. So the sense of self divides out of that neutrality. And because it's not, there's no grist there. It doesn't feel like it can grab a hold of anything. It just feels like it's not being used. The sense of self doesn't feel like it's being, that it can grip something in the midst of the ordinary. It decides to zone out. It's worse than that. It decides to make the moment aversive. For when we start saying this is boring, it's no longer neutral anymore, is it? We've made it an enemy, an antagonist. And now it has personal implications, right? It has personal implications. And as the sense of me, I don't have anything to complain about when it's neutral. I can't you know, I can't yell at it because it's just like flat land, you know, it's vanilla ice cream. It's like it doesn't invite a response. So I don't like that. And so I create the aversive response I need. See, boredom is the holder of the illusion. I need more stimulation. I can't just be quiet and content with the raw ingredients of life. I need more stimulation. And this culture is addicted to that more stimulation. I need more excitement. The excitement factor plays upon the excitement factor of the culture, doesn't it? Life should be full of peaks and few valleys. That's what we think. We think, you know, if I had this all together, I would stay in an engaged, entertaining. It wouldn't get any better than this, on and on. And the lows are an imposition on us. You know, it's interesting, but we think life should be vital, it should be clear, it should be energetic. And I think that's one of the reasons that many of us have such a difficult time with sleepiness. When we're on retreat or even in our city, it doesn't contain the grist for our, you know, for it doesn't, it's not energetic. It's not inducing a sense of empowerment. In fact, it feels just the opposite. It feels like it's draining the power away. And so in some ways, sleepiness can be one of the more difficult hindrances that we face. And also within that sleepiness, of course, is the context of life just being boring. It's just being drugged. I'm being drugged out of this. Now, let me just give you an example of what real meditation looks like. If the stage behind me, the curtain on the stage behind me was just a clear picture, screen, then what would cross on that screen would be the different states of mind throughout the day. Annoyance and anger and frustration and joy and happiness and on, they'd just dance across the stage. And as onlookers, we would love to see energetic dancers and colorful dancers and pretty dancers and entertaining dancers, etc., except that's not the state of the characters that dance across that stage. They contain many, many different characteristics, and some of them aren't very pleasant at all. Now, all of that together is the meditation. The screen is the meditation. Not the specific characters, the states of mind that dance through. But think how many times we get lost within the characterization, whether wanting this character and not that, this actor and not that one, and lose the sense that the screen is the meditation, that which holds all the characters, that which gives space to everything that arises. Now you can see that when boredom dances on that screen, we're in contention with it. The screen is never in contention with what is projected upon it. Never. Never, is it? That is the unconditioned holding of the conditioned reference to the character. But we form the shadow boxer to each character that we disapprove of out there. And therefore we are conditioning a new character called me that has trouble with this character called boredom. Both of those things are dancing on the screen. Both of those imprints are on the screen itself. The screen doesn't move, doesn't even care what's on it. It just holds whatever is there. Let us move our meditation so that it rests with the power of the screen, not with the tension between the characters. Is this making sense? So then, in that sense, is clarity better than sleepiness? You see? How do you define your meditation? What characters must be on that screen, on that stage, in order for you to define your meditation as successful? And when I make a suggestion, is awareness sleepy? I'm essentially saying, is the screen sleepy? Though sleepiness may be dancing on it? Is the screen bored, though boredom may be crossing at that moment? So let us look at the qualities and characteristics of boredom, as we did worry a couple of weeks ago. And I think it gets very interesting as we begin to flesh out what boredom looks like, what it compels us to do, what it forces us to consider or not consider. And then when we start looking at this thing from some objectivity, we can begin to see how we lose everything by investing or inserting identity within any state of mind, but in this case, boredom. So simplicity is living life on its terms, right? When you allow life to be lived in just in accordance to what's arising, rather than trying to entertain or intensify the moment in any way, you're just being present to life as it is, you can see that living with what is also a simple heart that isn't making demands upon the moment, but is abiding very directly and clearly within the moment. So if that's the definition of simplicity, boredom is inducing excitement in order to live. You see? Boredom is investing in the moment not for what it is, but for what it's not. It wants something else besides what the moment is offering. The mind state of boredom is not interested in the present, the simplicity of the present, or what is within the present. It's looking through the present to an expectation of what might evolve so that it will be more exciting, more entertaining, something more enlivening, more energetic, so that the characters of energy and vitality and sort of the thrill of the intensity of all those characters is what boredom is actually waiting for. And the sense of boredom just sort of sums up the moment as not worth even perceiving. Now, excitement is a character passage on that screen. But joy is something quite different. Joy arises by holding the screen's view of all the characters that are dancing, rather than investing and identifying with each character. So if you want joy, you can get entertainment, you can get momentary happiness from the different characters as they pass, but the problem is that no character stays on the screen. They come and they go. The screen is what remains. And if you give enough space to the characters as they move through, and less identity to each character as it's performing, you'll be a sense of joy, even though the sense of boredom, there'll be some resonance of these old characters as they dance through, but the whole thing will be held in joy, within joy. Joy is the space in which life is lived. Another characteristic of boredom, which I think is an interesting one, is a partial heart. It's like, oh, you know, I don't really want to show up right now. It's like, you know, do I really want this moment? It's like a competing desire. So there's a catch-22. It says, unless, and I know that spiritually we all know that, unless I show up for this moment, I missed my spiritual opportunity within this moment, but I'm not going to show up for boredom. That's why would I show up for boredom? It's boring. See, our explanation, our summation of what is occurring comes through the state of mind. The state of mind defines what the moment is. That's when we're totally assumed by the character on the stage. Totally assumed, totally focused, totally identified. You look through the state of mind holds our entire world, colors it 100%, is convincing 100%. And that's why we don't, as we change our belief system, as the new character arrives on stage, so how could I have been bored? God, this is great. Dude, look at this. This is really fantastic. I'm excited. And then the next character comes. And through the course of a single day, there is a streamline of characters, each one convincing us absolutely of its reality. Convincing us how? Convincing us through its emotional involvement and through its language, what it tells us about the present. Because each state has a conversation that it holds that contains our energy, contains our consciousness. And each conversation arises, within that conversation arises a certain emotional state. We have convinced ourselves that something isn't worth seeing. We feel bored. With boredom comes new, renewed conversation. Oh, this is awful. I can't. Oh, I don't know. When is this going to end? Oh, this is awful. Making it more and more horrible, more and more tension associated with what? Nothing. That's the problem with them. There's nothing going on. It's not like it's even aversive to begin with. It's just nothing. Oh, this is awful. What's awful about it? Life itself is never boring. It's the state of mind that we see through that makes it boring. I hope you got that. It's like a very bad... I'm going out there a little bit. We think colors are inherent in the object itself. They are not. They are the pigment. Everything that has color has a certain pigment. Light hits that, absorbs all the other colors except the color that it's expressing, and then the light reflects back that color because the pigment absorbed all the other colors. The light contains the color, not the object. But we are so convinced that the ceiling is, the floor is, I am, that is, when it's the light that does the coloring. In the same way, it's our state of mind that projects the moment. It's not the moment. It's not the living reality of life. It's the state of mind. It's the light from our state of mind that tells us everything. The conditioned reference of everything that we see. So another quality of boredom is that it blocks interest. Now, this is an important one because the Dharma depends upon our interest. And yet, the moment, another catch-22 is that, I know I'm supposed to be interested, but this is boring. So the boredom is a lack of interest. So how can I be interested in something that's boring? It seems paradoxical, doesn't it? Okay, but there is the heart, not your mind, but the heart can get interested in where that interest is, if you can follow that verbal sleight of hand. It says, I know this. What's going on here? Life is not interesting to me in this. What is going on? And that, when it says, what is going on in this moment, it gets interested in what's blocking the interest. It says, what is going on? It gets interested in the boredom itself. What's going on here? And as we get interested in the boredom itself, guess what happens to the boredom? Boredom can't coexist with interest. Now, we're not doing that so that we'll dissipate boredom, because that's just shadow boxing. But the natural response of the heart is that it gets, whatever blocks it, it gets very interested in it. And it, because it knows that its full expression is being denied or limited. And at some point, that becomes more important than the air you breathe, is where we are being limited in this moment, where we are blocking the full Monty of life. And so whenever we slip into a state of mind, that state of mind holds us at a disadvantage. And each state of mind is a disadvantaged representation of life. And so it's because we have believed in it. The only thing it can do to us is to invite our belief of it. And because we have believed in each character as they have danced across the stage and have completely disregarded the space around each character, we only believe in the character. So when one character comes on, we totally, whatever that state of mind is, that's our life. That's our definition of reality. Remember that the force that dissipates conditioning is interest. To work with that interest in our spiritual lives. And the interest will be aroused not within the character itself, although some characters are more interesting than others, and this is happiness, I'm really interested in this. This is sadness, I'm not very interested in this. The interest will be influenced by the pleasant or unpleasantness of each character. But there is an interest in the space around each character. The interest of seeing what it does that limits my total involvement in life in every moment. Oh, look at this. What's this? What's this character on this stage? And that characteristic of boredom is that lack of focus. You know, it's as if I don't really want to focus. There's nothing here worth focusing on. It's like this again, and now it's this again. So we say, okay, this again. Let me look at what this again means. Let me just see this. Now you get very serious and resolved. See, what is bored? What is it? Where do I feel it? What's it saying in my mind that covers, that is so conclusive about? Let me just take this apart for a moment. It's a hard one because we really believe that boredom is true in that moment. We think it's really boring. And that's why we need that sense of resolve and willingness to look and to bring forth that interest, even within the most difficult states of mind as they arise. Now, one of the more difficult aspects of boredom, and the reason that I think in this culture it has such a enormous control over us, is that it also feeds doubt. Huge. When we feel bored, we think, oh, you know, there's nothing to this. I've put all this energy into my meditation, my sitting, and there's just nothing going on. This is it. This is the state of my attention is this moment. And is there anything other than this? Not likely. And so it gives us a sense of doubting about life itself. life is just kind of worthless. It's not really worth living. And it, again, it just, never mind that it only lasts a little bit of time, but in that time it lasts, it has such an induced habit and conditioned reference to everything that its duration, its intellectual duration, lasts longer than just its state of mind. The state of mind passes through, but still I'm thinking, oh, you know, I don't know if I'm really up for this. I really saw how awful, you know, how... And on it goes. We just keep festering and fostering that further sense of doubt in ourselves. We also think it implies something about me. If I'm feeling bored, what's the... Oh, my God, maybe I'm boring. Maybe this implies something about the state of my character. And each of us, because we have it the central issue, most of us have it as a central issue, and a sense of not being worthy, that's an easy pattern for boredom to invest in. Oh, you know, this proves that, this feeling proves that I'm, as the very image that I believe about myself is true, or why would I be feeling this about myself? Come on. Can't do that. We've got to stand up to this stuff. We have to rise up. That's why we meet as a group. That's why we invest in each other's welfare as well as our own. All of us together in this. This sense of lifeless energy, this uninteresting sense of lifeless energy, you know. Because very close is that assumption of ordinariness and routine. It's like, oh God. You know, it's so much we can see because it so much is represented there through our image. Well, then maybe if I'll try to entertain myself and get where I'm going to invest. I'm not going to look at the image because that's too painful. I'll wait for something pleasant to come. In fact, I'll turn on the radio and invite somebody over for dinner and paint the house. I'll do whatever I need to just uplift the energy so that the boredom will dissipate and then I'll feel good again. Because God knows what I would have to be if I lived through this ordinariness. It's easier to escape within the pleasure we can create. And there's a deep fear of what life may be, and I want to bring it, I like to verbalize this thing. Like on this conference, I didn't get a chance, but I really wanted to say in the beginning, I said, okay, listen, I want each of us to verbalize the opinions that we have about each other's traditions. Give it words so I can hear it. Don't just stay in there and pretend like it doesn't exist. Prejudice never ends by denial. But let's look at it and see if it has any truth. In the same way, let's look at this and see if it has any truth. Let's see what it's telling us. Because one of the things we fear is that maybe life isn't worth living. It doesn't hold enough to be worth living. Some of us are afraid to say that because we'll make it true if we say it. But let's say it. See if it's true. I don't go the other way. I say, okay, if it's not worth living and I can prove it, then great. I've come to the end of my... I at least know the final results of this thing. All of life equals boredom. I'll pass the great exam. Fine. All right? But you got to really be sincere about it and see. Anyway... You see? Because thoughts seem to offer so much more. You know, if I'm bored, I can think pleasant thoughts. I can do a little. Why would I want to be with boredom when I can think my way out of it? We have to be very wise to this. You see, boredom doesn't want to go beyond its will. It gets stuck within its own conclusion. It just doesn't want to even test that conclusion. It's a defender of the status quo. Just, you know, it's, I don't have enough energy. It's like there's a loss of energy and enthusiasm. I'll just ride this one out a little bit. Just give me a soft pillow. But that's not the way of consciousness. That's the way of the unconscious. The way of consciousness is the way of seeing this impenetrable shield . We hate boredom because it takes us to the ordinary, what we've always been, what we always will be, just the status quo of ourselves, the ordinary routine. There's nothing about me that's outstanding or unique at all, says boredom. But the sacred is found within the ordinary. Now, how can that be? How can the sacred be found within the ordinary when the ordinary is what we have spent our whole life running from, not wanting to be defined? Because the ordinary, in order to be sacred, is experienced without words. It is the words of boredom that create the landscape of treachery. It is not the life that's lived in that moment. The words form the boredom, create and condition the boredom over and over again, repetitively, so that I see through the words of what this moment contains. If I'm quiet with those words, what I thought was so mundane, ordinary, and boring becomes life-fulfilling, becomes rich, becomes wondrous. Now I'm no longer dancing on the stage. Now the space has consumed the field. The figures are just shadows. In fact, the space, when fully embraced, ends the shadows. Boredom means nothing beyond the words that invited it and the emotions that followed the words. So what we're doing is looking at each distortion of mind, each state of mind, each character. We're listening to what it has told us about life when lived as that character. When you dress up as the character of boredom, you know only the world through that vantage point. But with a little objectivity, a little space, we begin to hear the very words it's telling us about life and questioning those words. That this moment isn't worth paying attention to? If ever there is a moment, that should be your spiritual hair should bristle. That this moment isn't worth paying attention to. Because you have just been dismissed spiritually. You have been negated to nothing, zero, less than nothing. Your time has been completely wasted if you follow one moment of belief in that. Let me see. I'm willing to risk it. I'm willing to say I have been an utter and complete failure in everything. But by God, I am going to risk it. I'm not going to pretend like it's not happening to me to get over it so that my spiritual life can continue afterwards. This is the afterwards. This is the moment that I have to bring it forth. This is the one that's asking me the most difficult question that any moment could ask. This moment is not worth paying attention to. You got me now. Let me see. I'm not moving. You just sink right into the character of boredom consciously. That's very different than sinking into the character of boredom unconsciously. Unconsciously, we just believe it and move on. Consciously, we're alive within that. What's the feeling? What's being said? And that state will never come back within the same conclusion and certainty once it is seen with that degree of resolve. And may it be so for all of us. Can we sit for a moment or two? So what state of mind is arising as we sit now? What character is dancing across your stage? Can you rise to meet it? Be good if somebody turned off that phone. You can see how you grow out of yourself. We're literally shifting paradigms every time we're willing to stand firm within the state of mind that's occurring. And again, the persuasion is, oh my God, if I keep doing this, what's left? What's going to be there for me? Who am I going to be? What are my explanations of life? Why would I act or be motivated if I'm not acting from the states of mind? All of those are ways that this paradigm holds itself in place through the logic of its own presentation, through its own argument. We have to be stronger than that. You don't know. So what? You don't know. Doesn't mean there isn't anything. It's just that you don't know it. How could we possibly know it? Because we only know the paradigm we've been in. How are you going to know what it's like on the moon if you've only lived on the earth? Doesn't mean it couldn't be great on the moon. Could jump 20 feet higher than we can here. Well, I don't want to go out there. It looks gray. I don't want to go. It's empty there. It's empty. I'm not going any place. It's empty. What's emptiness mean? Maybe it's empty of pain. Okay. So any questions or comments that anyone might have, I'd be happy to to see if I can respond. She says that she sees endless opportunities to distract herself from boredom so that she never feels it, but she could see that there could be a real opportunity if she were willing to feel it, because the avoidance of it has its own tension, you know, that you may not see it immediately, but when you're constantly trying to sort of raise the amplitude of our living experience, so there's a certain fatigue that brings forth. When you're always answering emails and checking for emails and looking at your phone to see if it's, you know, because you want to be needed, you know, and all of that. And we have created an enormous amount of distractibility within our culture, within the world itself now. And it's because of something. It's because of something. We've done that because there's something that we don't want to see. Or we want to believe that we are something that we're not. Some way that we want to build an image that is a belief about ourselves that isn't there unless we have all this gadgetry. So when we feel that sense of nothing particularly is going on, first you have to be very careful that you even catch it when it does arise, because it has such a compelling reaction to it that, before you know it, you're finding yourself at the TV or whatever the form of entertainment is. And just say, okay, let me just sit here for a second. And you're not even at the TV, you're on channel hopping, because none of them are like, Okay, so let's just take the old I Love Lucy episode. Now the attention goes here, you see. You're calling it back. You're not fleeing. What does this feel like? Let this be the show of choice. The only reason you'll ever do this, the only reason, is because you see the limitation of not doing it. You see a life that's lived in the escape methods as being laborious. What do you think it's going to be like when you die? You think you're going to have 12 channels? Right? All of the things that we're running from are going to find us at some point. We had better, if no other reason than for that, better take them on now and square ourselves.
I think boredom can take over when you're thinking your life should be better than it is, and there's something in the way. You're in line, or you're waiting for the bus, or you're waiting for the end of the workday. Wrong, you know, I have to wait, but I'll bear through it, but I'm bored, and I'm an important person, a great life, and it's just waiting for me, but now I have this 8 hours.
Actually, that's well stated. She just spoke the mind state very nicely, and she said, you know, that you're in line, and you're behind all these lesser human beings. And my life is so important, they should let me up front. They should have a sign, Rodney, you first. How come they don't realize that when I'm standing back here? That I'm more important than all of you. You know, go this way. Instead of going that way, go this way. How can the, what how can this moment be diminished? Waiting in line is still a full moment. It's a full moment of waiting in line. There's no even waiting. It's just a full moment of the expression of aliveness in this configuration. Now I'm another step towards the counter. Now it's a full expression of me being having one less person in front of me. Now I'm at the counter. It's like waiting for the bus is important as being on the bus. Being on the bus is important as arriving at home. Whatever we're going to do, the doing of that is as important as the arrival of what we're trying to do. You have to prove that life is just as important now as it is as to where you want to go. Where you want to go holds your desire, but your desire doesn't hold life. It holds your desire. Your desire holds the reason that you won't show up now. Showing up now is never diminished whenever you show up. It's always, always equal to whatever other moment, at whatever other time you decide to arrive. Even when all your expectations are met, everything's lined up, the party's going in your favor, that moment is no more than the preparation for the party itself. It's no grander, it's no fuller, it's no more complete. Now, you have to prove that to you. The only thing that will ever disprove that to you are the states of mind on the way to arriving to what you want to do. If you believe in the states of mind, by their very nature, will say life isn't worth living now, wait, soon it will be when the party is in full swing. It always has a defined time when it's worthwhile showing up. Meanwhile, everything else has been missed. Believe me, even the time when you show up, you'll find a reason not to. Because to show up means that you have no formation. Anytime we show up completely and resolve ourselves to showing up, we have no reason. The sense of self can't get formed within showing up. It doesn't have any. It forms itself with the idea that I have to show up soon. It doesn't form itself in the actual showing up. And so that's why we never show up, because we want to be formed. We like the idea. We don't like the reality. So reality must have some other advantage besides just the formation of me. Has to, or why would the world have these perennial philosophies? Why would spirituality not have died in the first day it was ever conceived if there was nothing to it? Let's see. Okay, I know a mind-driven world that always says the future is where it's at, the present isn't. Okay, I know that world. I've lived it. I know it. Now that's it. I'm going to test the other world. Now there's a paradigm shift that occurs. See, as we stop, the space gets larger. As long as we're compelling ourselves forward, the space is packaged within that sense of me. As we stop and we become more ambiguous of what we are, the space gets larger. Now, the screen is seen. Now, what's the value of that? So what? Everything changes. We're not on the same planet anymore. And I don't mean that physically. I mean that perceptually. And I don't mean that I don't see you there and me here. I mean that the whole configuration of subject and object, separation and distance and time, it all gets rearranged. And it gets rearranged towards the advantage of life itself. Not towards the advantage of separate existences within life, but as a whole of life, as the whole of life. And you realize, oh, wow, this is the only way it can ever survive. This is the only way life can ever survive as a whole. Have what? Type A. Yeah. Yeah.
So they call up and want to do something. How do you get across the idea of doing nothing?
Right. So how do you, somebody calls you up and asks you to do something, how do you express to them the beauty of doing nothing? Well, doing nothing doesn't mean that you have to do nothing. You can carry doing nothing and doing something. You can carry doing nothing and hiking. You can carry doing nothing and conversation. You can carry doing nothing and you will feel unified within that as well. It doesn't mean that there's inactivity. There means that there is psychic inactivity that is resting in a way that we never realized it was possible. But the body continues to move in whatever way it does. And hiking is a perfect example of how it would be in alignment with doing nothing, hiking through the woods or doing something, or conversation even. It's just that when conversation occurs, we get so lost in the image that we're trying to propel within that conversation that we lose the ground of the nothing doing. That'll have to wait for another talk. But to all of you, let us be together in this. This is what Sangha is. Let's be together. Move this thing forward. Doesn't require you being Buddhist, Christian, Hindu. You can be anything you'd like or nothing. It's all fine. In fact, Stephen Batchelor was at this conference. He just wrote a book called The Buddhist Atheist or something. I don't know. So it doesn't matter. Belief systems do not matter in this. So you don't have to be anything. But you can feel the life that runs through your veins. And that you can't escape. Let's make it conscious, that's all.